Welcome to the Blue Dot Podcast. Please join us as we discuss what's happening in Harrison County, Indiana.
Hey, Harrison County. I'm Elmer Ramos.
And I'm Graylin Porter, and you're listening to the Blue Dot Podcast.
Hello, Harrison County, and welcome to another episode of the Blue Dot. This is episode 13, right?
13. Episode 13. Oh, man. Lucky 13.
Lucky 13.
Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift's favorite number.
And I'm actually really excited. Today is going to be like, I hope everyone's full, or I hope that everyone is ready to be filled with a lot of content. I hope you're not full. I hope you're ready to be filled with
content. I am full. I just ate lunch and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
I will say that, I don't want to be a horrible downer, but I am feeling a little down. Just the news has been just grim, horrible.
I completely agree.
At a loss with a lot of different issues. I'm sure we'll talk about them. But we do have a wonderful guest. Randa Deaton's going to be on today, who is a wealth of knowledge regarding healthcare. And she's going to try and explain to us, we throw around terms like Medicare for all and that kind of thing. But what would that mean? What would that look like actually in practice? And she actually has the knowledge of the healthcare system as far as in the corporate world to kind of, is it even possible, And I think that that's something we really need, because healthcare is something that affects everyone. It's clearly a bridge issue that brings people together from both parties. And it's going to be really, really good. So I'm excited to talk to her. Yeah, for a change, the local stuff is, kind of here or there, but, the national news is pretty bleak. The recent shooting in Indianapolis, and then, of course, the shooting of Dante Wright. I think that's how you say his first name.
I believe so, yeah. And yeah. I am so, to me, it feels like nothing is really, with the Derek Chauvin's trial and all that, I mean, they're on day 14 of the trial. It's just, First off, it's like unbelievable how they're trying to find any reason to not convict when we all know that this was, it was a murder. was a public execution. It's all these different things that keep being put in place to just make it prolong the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And this other shooting with Dante Wright just makes me feel like that no one cares. Like nothing's happening. Nothing, nationally is even being put in place to change the constant, these things that are happening.
It feels so overwhelming because it just feels like something that is so far gone. I remember Obama said, if Sandy Hook didn't change things, then I don't know what will or if it ever can. And that really, to me, I that's how I feel. And now I feel like it's even worse, because what wears me out is the cycle of it. And of course, now people have made memes and things about it, where you have something and then you get on social media and then everyone, throws up the posts about it and the hashtags about it, and they're outraged and blah, blah, blah. And then it goes away and everyone goes back to normal. Then it happens again. Then it does. And it's almost as if I can't even get online the day or two after these things happen, because I see people that 3 weeks ago didn't give a shit talking about it. And it makes me very angry and I get really mad and it's not good.
Yeah, and the whole thing about accidentally shooting him, and thinking it was a taser, but it wasn't. I mean, there is a sign. I don't know. Do you even know what a taser or the tasers they use look like?
No.
So a taser weighs about your phone, an iPhone. That's how much it weighs. It's very light, and a gun weighs
a lot more than that, I would assume.
Hold on. I have a A gun weighs 2.6 pounds. A taser weighs 8 ounces. A taser is completely yellow and a gun is black. Like, I think, and the whole thing where like she was 20 years of experience and all that, like, nothing adds up to, you know, it's like nothing's being done about this.
And, you know, people make mistakes. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, it's impossible for a police officer to make a mistake. But if that's the case, you need to just say, I made a mistake and stop. And it shouldn't have happened. It should have never happened, period.
Exactly. And I understand that people, you know, like people will resist arrest. I understand that too. It's not like, you know, but I also understand that they are resisting arrest because there's already a reputation in place where like, it's just.
And I have a hard time talking about it as like a privileged white woman. And you know, somebody who I really admire, Brittany Packnett Cunningham, she's an activist. She said, if you build an institution out of slave patrols, its character will always be violent toward the descendants of the enslaved. Harm is not just possible through American policing, it is promised. You know, this is how the American police system was started, to capture slaves. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised. And I can't even imagine what it would feel like to be a black person right now. I'm not even going to try to sit here and say I know what it's like.
Yeah.
I just feel very helpless.
Yeah. And
then, yeah.
Yeah. I completely agree. You can't begin to explain it.
Yeah. And I did want to talk about, you know, in terms of the Indianapolis shooting, and we've had a couple people reach out to us or to me in the past week about maybe talking about the gun control issue on the show, like having a separate episode, which I think would be good. I personally really struggle with how to talk about it as a representative, the representative of the Democratic Party here in the county, because I know what I think and I'm unapologetic about what I think, but it is definitely not what's popular here. And so you get into that, well, do we, you know, put our flag in this issue and say this is what we unapologetically believe, even though we know it's incredibly not unpopular?
I think there's certain guns that should not be available. Yeah. To just, you know, and we're not going to get into it, but like this whole topic, I mean, I understand like it shouldn't be that easy to get certain things. And I understand that people around here are hunting and, but that's, I think to me, that's fine. Like,
right.
You're a hunter. That's a sport. Okay.
But I agree.
Getting a military weapon. What do you need it for? What are you going to, you know, I don't know, but we won't get into it.
Well, and I agree completely. And you know, I will say, like, in terms of, you know, an AR-15, this is what frustrates me the most is when I was running for county council, I had multiple people on Facebook ask me if I was a proponent of banning AR-15s. First of all, what the hell does that have to do with county council? Second, yeah, I am. I am for it. I don't think we should have them. And you have examples of other countries that have done this and it has worked. So I'm sorry. I do think so. And I think as Democrats, if we believe that, we need to just be willing to say we do. There's a book, Malcolm Gladwell's latest book, Talking to Strangers. He has a chapter in there about Sylvia Plath, of all people, who killed herself with a gas oven in the 1970s or 60s. But in the UK, you know, they had something called town gas, which was toxic if you, you know, put your head in the oven and you could easily kill yourself. It was painless. It was quick. You just literally fell asleep. And so their suicide rate was very high. And when that was phased out, suicides dropped by half and weren't replaced with any other method. So if you make something easy, it will happen more. And if it's not as easy, it will not happen. It's that argument of, well, people are going to shoot people anyway. It doesn't matter what kind of gun it is. That is not true. It is literally not true.
I Yeah, I completely agree with your statement there. I think, yeah. Well, and these are all like, okay, the people will still have guns, people can still shoot, but this is like a mass killing weapon. Like, you will kill a ton more people with an AR-15 than you will with like a handgun.
Yeah, and again, just to reiterate, it's not that we think you shouldn't be able to own a gun. That is not it. That is not what I believe. Mm-hmm. It's a certain kind of gun.
Yes.
And 100%. I think that if we're not willing to see the nuance of that, then we have nowhere to go.
Exactly. No, 100%. I think the message gets distracted because you say one thing and they believe this other bigger picture.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, we're getting a little deep and negative here. All right.
Sorry, I'm just not in a mood anymore with that issue. I'm really not, and I'm not willing to. I'm just not. Okay.
Well, we're gonna get lively here.
Okay,
minute,
with the community crossings and the highway department. Woo!
So what do we have going on there?
The highway department has been requesting some funding to support a $1 million grant from the state to basically work on some roads, and it's a grant called Community Crossings, which I think we get every year for different projects, or maybe every couple years. I'm not quite sure on that. We can look that up, but it's something that comes around over and over again. And this year, a large part of the project is going to be working on a road that we recently acquired in a controversial, you know, we've talked about it before, decision by the commissioners to take on 32 miles of road from the state. So a lot of the council was not happy about this because now a lot of county money is going to go to roads that we just got rather than roads that have needed work prior. Mm-hmm. So the vote was last Monday night, and we talked about it last episode, how they got in kind of a heated exchange. And so this was the meeting that they were voting on it. And again, we had Kyle Nix, you know, he lamented that there's not enough money to do anything.
With the casino being shut down, it's like we went from a two-income county to a one-income county. And unfortunately, some things got to be said no to.
So he was not super excited about doing it. And they had basically an hour plus long discussion of it again. Mm-hmm. And then they voted to approve it.
Wow.
So, well, and you know, honestly, I don't know where I stand with it. I kind of say, like, well, it's kind of dumb to turn down $1 million of grant money from the state and tarnish our relationship with them. They may not give it to us again. I really do see both sides of this issue. I can totally identify and see the pros of both sides, but again, to me, it's just it's just the
handling
torture. Yeah, it's just the tortured poor Kevin Russell, the head of the highway department, had to like just stand up there and just talk about this for hours when it should have been just kind of a no brainer thing.
Yeah,
for no real reason other than some of the council just doesn't like it. I don't know. It just seemed unnecessary, the whole deal. So
sounds like they don't have anything better to do.
Yeah. To me, this whole issue just kind of illustrates the inefficiency and just messiness of local government that we have. And, you know, Kevin Russell, the head of the highway department, said that we've never had a project with this level of controversy, you know? So this is at the height. This is the drama right here. And I don't know if I agree with him, but I think maybe.
But how much controversy? Like, is it because we're speaking about it in addition to anybody else? Or what controversy?
I don't think we're a factor on this one. I think he's talking about just the acquiring of this road.
Gotcha.
Because when it did happen last year, there was a massive, like, you know, surge. It got on the local news in Louisville, and it was a pretty big deal. But you know, so nothing much to report there. I'm kind of happy they went ahead with it, and we can credit Richard Gurdon and Jenny Capelli for that, because they were basically like, yeah, I know we don't want to do the work on these roads, but this is kind of silly to mess up our whole relationship with NDOT. So let's just go ahead and do this, okay?
And I think that there's probably other projects that they have to work on together, so that can make sense not to tarnish that relationship. Yeah.
Today we're joined by our friend, Randa Deaton. She's a 25-year resident of Harrison County. And how long have you worked in the healthcare realm, like your whole career?
Well, no, I come from human resources, but the last 15 years I've been in healthcare benefits. Yeah.
Okay. You speak nationally on healthcare improvement, and you've spoken especially to the high cost of healthcare to the Democrats. You've come in and presented to us before, but we're just so glad you're here. You're just such a wealth of knowledge.
Welcome.
thanks for having me. I love your podcast.
Well, thank you. So basically, you know, I just use myself as an example. I know nothing about healthcare, you know, and I always say if it wasn't for my husband, I might just be homeless and not know, like when it comes to like bureaucratic things, and I'm a mess. And so when it comes to navigating the healthcare system and insurance, I wish I had something to tell me how it works in a way that makes sense, because I feel like there isn't a lot out there that, you know, to just say, hey, as an adult, this is how you navigate, you know, health insurance. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, healthcare literacy is what we call that. Or insurance literacy is a huge issue, and our health system is so complex. And even those of us that work in healthcare have the same difficulties in navigating the system. So you're not alone.
Is that the intention, to make it hard to understand?
No, I don't think that's the intention. It's just so many disparate systems that are all pieced together. And so we don't really have like a coherent, you know, we don't have a patient identifier that goes across the nation, right? And we don't have systems that all talk to one another. So, you know, we just, you know, we have a lot of different systems and they don't always communicate well together. And they a lot too.
Yeah. That's actually the main, like one of the main things about it is like, there's like no one profile that every doctor can have access to understand the patient. It's like every time you go to a different provider or anything like that, it's like, it's all starting fresh all over again, from what I understand.
Exactly.
And it's just, there's a lot of issues that come from that too. And especially, I think COVID has kind of proven that even more.
Yeah. And again, I remember when I first got pregnant with my first child, and I've never broken a bone. I've never had a surgery before that. And, you know, I just didn't go to the doctor much, frankly. And so all of a sudden I was kind of, all right, I'm going to be at the doctor at least once a month. And I remember when we first went in for our first appointment, at the end of the appointment, we were, you know, settling up and scheduling the next one. And Andrew asked the person working, how do we pay for this? How do we pay for having a baby? And the person said, it's global. And we literally were like, what does that mean? Like, literally, like, so it just felt, I felt very much just like at the mercy of like at the system. And as far as I know, the U.S. pays a lot more for our healthcare than any other country. I know that's a very simple statement, but I think that's correct.
That is correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to the healthcare navigation. You know, it is really important, and everyone's trying to do this, but to, you know, advanced primary care is kind of this concept where you are like the quarterback for someone's healthcare. And so it is really important for everyone to have a primary care provider that they trust, that if possible is culturally representative, background. And so, you know, I think that's just really important. And so when people think about healthcare literacy, that's often something that has been promoted for a long time, but people don't always stick with their primary care. But you want to find someone you trust and you have a good experience with that's really advocating for you and the quality of care. And then, mm-hmm. you know, when you go to those specialists, you know, you always want to trust the providers, but also verify, you know, what they're saying. Maybe you need a second opinion. So I just, you know, one of the things that we need to do as consumers is not settle, you know, mm-hmm. to have really, you know, respectful experiences, and demand exceptional care. And so that's, you know, figuring out how to do that is really challenging because a lot of our healthcare information is not transparent, including the costs of care.
Yeah. That's basically the thing that I am just fascinated by is what healthcare costs and why it costs what it costs.
Yeah. So does everyone. I mean, you know, it's 18% of our GDP. We spend more than double that of comparable countries. Yet we don't use a lot more resources. We don't have, you're not seeing, you know, extraordinarily higher quality. We do in some areas. So, you know, Hugh Reinhart is a famous economist, and he wrote a journal article on health affairs in 2003 and said, it's the price is stupid. and that's why, I mean, we just, mm-hmm. the prices are higher in the US. And so he passed away. A group of economists in 2019 wrote a second article, you know, 16 years later that said, it's still the price is stupid. Essentially we have, you know, high costs, high prices in healthcare.
For no reason.
There's no correlation between quality and cost. You know, it's like, if you look at it, it's like a scatter plot all over a graph. So, you know, ideally you would mm-hmm. see as the cost would go up, that you would see, you know, the quality go up, but that's not how healthcare works.
And has it always been that way? Or would you say that is a recent thing? Like recent being maybe the past 30 years?
You know, this, I'm trying to think when the Quality Chasm book came out several years, a long time ago. The national healthcare quality strategy for the United States has been the triple aim goals of better health, better cost, and better experiences for 20 years. So, mm-hmm. I mean, a really long time we've had this national quality strategy. Better health, better care, and lower costs is the triple aim goals. We've been working on this for a really long time. And unfortunately, you know, we are not making a lot of progress.
No.
So, with that said, I probably am not doing a great job in my work because, you know, we're still working on this kind of high cost of care. And what you see is that, you know, you'll see in a rural area, unfortunately, like hospitals closing because they're not getting enough revenue. And then you see in other areas where hospitals are charging 500% of Medicare prices to employer-sponsored insurance for the mm-hmm. exact same services.
In Indiana, I remember from the last time you gave a presentation that Indiana is quite high there.
Yeah. So we hit the New York Times as the highest cost state in the nation in the RAND study that was done by the Employers Forum of Indiana. Now, since that, the study has been expanded, and so Indiana isn't as high, but it's still 300. So employer-sponsored insurance is like if you work for a business and they provide insurance to you, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have Medicare, which is for 65 plus, and you don't have Medicaid, which is for lower income citizens. If you're on employer-sponsored insurance, you know, in Indiana, hospital care is 300% of what Medicare would pay.
Why? Why? It's
because they can?
It's bizarre. And it's,
is it that simple?
Yeah, I mean, the hospital association wouldn't say that.
Obviously.
I'll tell you what they would say. And these are true things is that, you know, they lose money on Medicaid. So mm-hmm. that's state insurance. Mm-hmm.
And these are hospitals. This is hospitals. Yeah.
So say 15%. and people can argue around what that price is. And then for Medicare, and we can, this is a hot topic, but, you know, Medicare is supposed to be a break-even rate. Because it takes into account wages, it takes into account whether you're teaching, it takes into risk adjustments for the patient mix. So if you have, you know, sicker patients, are you able mm-hmm. to get a risk adjustment? Because obviously you're going to have, you know, higher costs. So with that said, so let's say that you lose on Medicare and Medicaid, then what is the appropriate price for the business community to pay?
Mm-hmm.
Is it 130%, 140%, 150%?
Right.
175, 200, 210, 250, 300, you know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So essentially, hospitals have to have commercial insurance to be able to, you know, invest. They need commercial payers to pay more to be able to make up for some of those differences. But the question is to what, you know, what is the appropriate percent relative to Medicare that people should pay, that businesses should pay?
Mm-hmm. Wow. it's so fascinating to me that, because I find it just such a house of cards, mm-hmm. you know, the healthcare system in the United States, that it's like it's this massive structure that's built on a tiny little pedestal that's like weaving back and forth. And Elmer, did you have something?
My experiences with all this, like in 2019, I had three surgeries, and I did my best to keep a binder with all my expenses and everything. And there was still, like, under the insurance that I had through my employer, there was all these expenses that they were covering. And then there was like a copay that I had to pay, but then sometimes I would never ever get a bill for that, which is good. That's the plus. Mm-hmm. I never got a bill. But it would say that in under the insurance that I was supposed to cover this much. I just never got a bill from any provider or anything. I guess it's going off topic, but like the system is so like not very specific, like so confusing that
It's not efficient, is what I noticed.
All these
about
other
it.
Things can come it's into how, play and like affect it even more, where it have nothing to do with it in some ways. I mean, am I wrong for thinking that? I guess I don't.
Yeah, tell us.
Well, you know, I mean, I understand the skepticism, because you know when you think about, and this is more of a drug pricing issue, but when you see that, you know, someone will buy an insulin and then jack it up, you know, 7,500%, so that they can make money, you know, that does happen. You know, but the way we pay for healthcare in the United States is just strange in the sense that, for example, we don't pay primary care very much. You know, essentially they have difficulty getting enough revenue. They have mainly like 8 minutes with mm-hmm. you. And their responsibilities are so extraordinary, to be able to look at all your prevention and chronic disease and educating you and, you know, making sure that you're getting appropriate mental health care and, you know, all these things. But we pay a lot for specialty care and hospital care.
Right.
And so there's some upside down, like we should be investing more in primary care. The other thing that's really weird about the way we pay, I should say, is that we're on a fee-for-service model. So that means basically it's kind of like a factory. You know, if you more widgets, the more widgets you have, the more money you make, right? And so the more the bill is. And so you'll hear a lot of people in the healthcare world say we need to move from, you know, volume of healthcare services. So all those things you were talking about, Elmer, on the mm-hmm. list, value. And so you'll see things like bundled payments. So a lot of talk about payment reform. So say you go in for a hip replacement, it would go from your, you know, kind of before you have your hip replacement to afterwards, make sure that you have PT. So in the case of like Graylin, she probably would maybe want to run a marathon afterwards. And I just want to be able to get up and down the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's called like shared decision making and kind of what our patient goals are. So what do I want to accomplish at the end of my hip replacement? What do you want to accomplish?
And right.
Realistic expectations, and then making sure there's no infection or readmission. So just kind of that whole continuum, there's a movement to move to this kind of paying for value of care.
Well, and that makes me think, is that maybe what they meant when we went in to have the baby and they were like, it's global? Is it mean that it's one cost? I think that's what we determined they meant, that it was it was one cost for all the care from start to finish.
I think that's what they meant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a lot of maternity bundles, you know, that are, you don't see a lot. I work primarily in Kentucky. You don't see a lot of value-based contracting. That's what we call it, value-based contracting in Kentucky. You see more of it in Indiana because of this hospital price study. And so a lot of the employers have partnered with the health insurance plans, you know, to try to move towards more value-based contracting.
Gotcha. And so, you know, to bring it into something that we hear kind of thrown around a lot, I mentioned it at the top of the interview, but Medicare for all, do you have an idea of what that means? Like, because even someone like me, I don't know what it means. I assume it's a stand-in for a single payer system or, you know, universal health care, these abstract things that we say that like we know what we're talking about, but we really don't know what we're talking about.
I think it's pretty abstract.
Yeah.
I think we're still pretty abstract. You know, I think you're right. I mean, it's a single payer, it's universal health care. It means that everyone would have access to health care. So, you know, in the kind of instance of a hospital, like right now, if you were in a car accident, that hospital has to have, you know, trauma surgeons and all of the equipment, but they don't get paid until the car accident victims actually get there and get paid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, talking about kind of that hospital piece, and but right now people are able to get uncompensated. The hospitals will provide uncompensated care. The idea, but if you have diabetes and you need insulin, you're not going to get that kind of care. So we have emergency care, but we don't really have a way to manage someone's chronic condition. The idea of a single payer is that everyone would have access to the same health care. So that 30 million or so people in America that don't have insurance would be covered. But we also have underinsured, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. People that have insurance, but they can't really afford their deductibles or their co-insurance or their co-pay. So they will delay care or avoid filling prescriptions because they have to pay for something else. So the concept, I think, is still in the abstract. It has gained in popularity over the years. So I think the question when I first started 15 years ago was, is healthcare a privilege or a right? And people kind of debated that. And mm-hmm. I think after the Affordable Care Act, that's a pretty popular program. And so you essentially have people, for the most part, the public believes that healthcare is a right.
I think that has definitely changed. Like, we're not going to be able to go back to what it was before the ACA.
Yeah. And so I think the idea of a single payer is just the concept of how do we still make sure that everyone has access to care when they need it, because at this point that we don't have that. So we have mm-hmm. lots of people that don't have insurance.
Yeah.
Now has there been studies where if we focused on primary care, would that bring the cost of specialty care down? Like if everyone is well taken care of on their primary issues, is that a thing that gets considered?
Yeah, I mean, that is the concept, and that is the belief, is that if you actually were able to have, we call it integrated delivery systems, and we have several of those in our community that you all are really familiar with, that, but they don't really get the kind of payments that they should. So I'll give you like the example in Cincinnati, they have something called PCP Plus. So that means, so if you go in, perhaps it's like, well, you know, they'll do a mental health screening. And if you, you know, screen positive, they may send you to a behavioral health therapist that's down the hallway. If your child is diagnosed with asthma, you get, may have a pharmacist that will explain to you how to use an inhaler and what you can expect. And they'll follow up. Are you having any problems? Because we know there's medicine problems. So, you know, it's just much more holistic. Some of them even have dental care, you know, physical therapy, comprehensive pain management. Like the list goes on of how they kind of integrate these delivery systems in a way that helps you, for example, perhaps if you have diabetes, manage your diabetes in a way that doesn't, you know, have take you down a road of complications where you may lose a limb or, yeah.
And so is this, when you say Cincinnati, is it, who is providing this kind of care in Cincinnati? Is it, or it's just
health systems, but it's kind of the whole community chose to do it. It's a government program. To my knowledge, you know, I know we don't have it in Louisville. We looked at it, but you know, I think at the time you had to have so many plans and it just wasn't the right timing. But there are models that have shown that it does work, Elmer. You know, I do think it, you know, it's easier said than done, but
yeah. We did get a question from somebody on Facebook, in anticipation of the episode, and it fits into this. She says, why is it not possible to have a single payer system? And I don't know if it is. It is possible, I would assume.
It's certainly possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for sure. And I think it's grown in popularity. I mean, I primarily work on how does the business community also thrive in paying for healthcare? So we work a lot on how we can, you know, improve commercial insurance. But going to the question of the listener, I mean, I think that we certainly could. But the thing is that it's kind of like, you know, any business, if you take a huge portion of their revenue out, how do they operate? You know, it, and I think the concept is that if we take away anything that's for profit, that means, and we could negotiate lower prices, which all of which are true, that we could do it. But those businesses are operating with a current stream of revenue. And so it's kind of like, you know, whether you're moving a barge, you know, turning. It would be a very slow. It's also 2 million jobs, about 2 million jobs that would be lost. So, you know, those are things that you would have to consider. Healthcare now is, you know, in a lot of cities, that's the number one employer. It's the largest employer. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider a single payer. It just is, there's just so many layers of change that would be required. Yeah.
Again, I feel like it's something that's, you know, built on a little bitty pedestal, and there's a lot of people that say, well, this is easy. We can just go to a single payer, and it would be like you just knocked out the bottom and it all came crashing down. I mean, you have to find something for it to sit on to stay up.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just something that would take a really long time to get to, but it certainly is possible. And I think there is growing public opinion. And there are some policies that have been put in place to try to move us more towards a value-based contracting system. One of the things that I know that in the public opinion, and I don't work on healthcare policy, so I had to kind of look to see what people think about payer, because that's not really an area that I spend a lot of time thinking about, but it sounds like people like it in the abstract until it actually may impact them
personally. Right.
Either like getting rid of their own healthcare benefits or taxes or whatever the case may be.
And I find that probably with a lot of issues. And I think something that would be important to talk about is, you know, switching to something that is more universal. Most people, I think, are worried about what that does to the quality of the care. You know, and I don't think that from what you've said, it's already not great. It's already very complex. It can't possibly be more complex. And, you know, as far as I've heard you mention the term rationing care, and that's what a lot of people are terrified of. If the system changes, will they not be able to receive care when they need it? And right. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't want my care rationed. I want to be able to go to the doctor just like we all do when we want. Say that, you know, unfortunately, we already have rationed care. We have people that aren't getting care. If you want to get into a rheumatologist, it's like 9 months in Louisville.
Yeah. I mean, some people, they'll call a dermatologist and it'll be, you know, six months before there's an appointment. And why is that? Like, what's happening there? Are they literally just that full of patients or is it about cost?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have a workforce issue. And I would say that the hardest thing to get into is primary. Well, I shouldn't say that. There are several like niche specialists that take a while to get into. But also it's hard to get into primary care as well. And you should be able to have open day scheduling. That's kind of a process, a workflow where if you have a sick child or something comes up that you can get in. So those are all practices that a lot of like really large health systems have figured out how to do with their electronic health records is kind of open scheduling. I don't know that the specialists have been able to do that quite as much. So there's some of them work on triaging system where I think I have someone in a very severe situation. So I'm going to try to get them in very quickly. So maybe in the next few weeks, but then there are other times where it's like, oh, I don't think this is I don't know that this is so serious. I'm going to push them off a little bit.
Which is essentially the same thing as, you know, a lot of people use as an example of what would happen if our healthcare system changed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we already have rationing of care. We already have people that can't get medicine. You know, we have new medicine that's coming out that's like $1 million. So these gene therapies are just amazing. And I can tell you that I want them. Something that I can, you know, if there's a time where I have a condition that can be cured, I want those. So how are we able to afford all this though? You know, the price just continues to go up and up. And, you know, we need healthcare to thrive, but we also need non-healthcare businesses to be able to thrive as well. And we need families to be able to afford care. And we've had 20 years of wage stagnation because of healthcare. And so healthcare outpaces inflation and wage growth. And so families have less money for food. They have less money for housing, clothing, entertainment, et cetera. And so, you know, we have to do something about healthcare. And I think, you know, some of the models around payment reform, some of the transparency tools that are coming out. So the hospitals now will have to put some pricing information out. You know, there's hope, but, you know, we do need some pretty strong reform to be able to kind of, you know, deal with this cost issue that we have in the United States.
I have a question about, and I don't think you, I mean, it's more about world, like how do other countries how do they do the universal health care, and why are we one of the few that doesn't have universal health care? Is it all profit based?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I know the answer to that.
That's why I hesitated asking it.
Well, and it's very hard for us to, because I feel like that's why the issue is so hard to talk about, because it's such a fundamental thing that the U.S. has decided they're in this lane with their healthcare. And it's like we've decided it a long time ago. And I don't know if we can undecide it. That's not a word, but.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's funny because, you know, we are a capitalist society. And I come from the, you know, I come from a corporation and that's where I've worked most of my life. So I, you know, I'm a strong believer that we need businesses thriving. And we also need healthcare thriving. You know, and so, I mean, I think that's the challenge. The issue is that, people talk about shoppable services. So typically how a market works is that you can see the price of something and the quality of something before you buy it. Like, I'm addicted to Amazon. Like, all these reviews.
Yeah.
I want to see like everything they say. And then I'm like, oh gosh, it's only like a 4.5 star.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. Don't we want this for healthcare? And isn't it nonsensical that we don't have it? It's like, you know, we don't know what it costs before. I mean, in what other industry is something secret? Like the price is secret, right?
Thank you so much for saying that, because that is something that, again, I go back to my original story. Like, the lady looked at us like we were insane for asking, how much is this going to cost?
Yeah.
The fact that they can't tell you is shocking to me.
It's crazy. And so, you know, that's, I mean, we really, you know, there are some places you can get some quality transparency. If you go to CMS star or CMS and their stars rating, you can look at like hospital safety. You can go to the Leapfrog, which has hospital safety ratings by hospital. There's some new laws around, you know, kind of pricing, but you really need to marry that together. I mean, there's no value in going to a low cost provider that has terrible outcomes. You know, it's worth paying extra for optimal outcomes. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you'd be able to see that and you would be able to shop. The thing is that a lot of people use this kind of, I have glasses on, you guys don't, but they'll use, you know, like the laser eye surgery, that this is such a great success of how the market works in healthcare. Well, I don't really have to get my eyes corrected. I can continue to wear glasses and my insurance isn't going to pay. So you'll see that what used to be a pretty expensive procedure is actually pretty shoppable and affordable now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People use that example a lot of how the market can work. But I don't have to have that. If I have an appendicitis or if you're having a heart attack, you're probably not able to shop right then.
And I think that, you know, if we're looking at it big picture, like, the way our system is set up is it would be the only thing that you could get away with doing this with is healthcare, right? Because people are never going to be like, nah, I just don't need that today. Yeah. You know, like, they're never going to say, oh, I changed my mind, it doesn't look that great. No, it's your life. You're going to get it no matter what. So of course it's going to be the thing that we don't know what it costs, and we'll make it cost whatever we want it to cost. It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, of course it doesn't make sense. Like, as far as a humane, anyway.
But kind of to Elmer's point, like, how do other, you know, the thing is, if you're going to have a free market and you're going to have a market, then you have to be able to shop the services and you have to know what you're paying for. And Amazon.com for my providers.
But
it doesn't exist yet.
So that when you say value-based, is that kind of what that means in a way? Like, trying to...
I know. Value means like, you know, we kind of put all the providers, we call providers means like, you know, physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, hospitals, anyone that provides care, behavioral health, physical therapy, everyone that provides care. You know, we kind of put them on a grid of like, what's the cost, what's the quality, and you want a high quality, affordable provider. Mm-hmm. We call high value.
Okay. Right. Okay.
You know, you want someone that provides affordable services. And when you look at the quality of care, you know, there is no correlation between quality of care and pricing or cost of care, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A lot of people would say, I'm willing to pay more. And I think, you know, everyone is like, I'm willing to pay more to get the best care possible.
Yeah.
That's what we want, right? We all want the best care possible. Have a hard time getting access to that data and information.
And just to touch on, you know, how other countries do it, you know, I don't have a ton of experience, but I did live in Norway for a little over a year. And again, it's just so fundamental that it's something you pay a whole lot for. You really do in taxing and other things. And It's just, that's something they are willing to do. They're willing to have their quality of life in other areas be a lot lower because things are so expensive, but then that money is given to the greater and everyone is given healthcare. As far as that, my personal experience, that was what I lived. You know, for instance, a beer at a restaurant, Miller Lite, say, is, you know, $30. The tax, yeah, the taxing on that obviously doesn't go all to health, but
yeah, I see
the taxes. There is a compromise mm-hmm. okay. there. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people, especially liberal people that are very pro universal healthcare, they want to pretend like the life is the same, but everyone's getting healthcare too. And I personally did not find that to be the experience. Now, I personally would rather everyone have healthcare. I think it's a more humane way to live and give up, you know, other things. I'm willing to pay more in taxes for people to have healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just my personal, but I'm not a business, you know, and like you say, Randa, I'd love to know, do you have any sense of what the business community at greater, you know, where do they want to see healthcare go? Because I see that, you know, employers are not happy at probably with the system as we have it now.
No. And there's a very business. I won't mention my name, but you would know it. Some of you may own some of their products, but you know, when the hospital prices were released in Indiana, said that's why we say anywhere but Indiana, meaning that they will put their business in any state but Indiana because the prices were so high for health. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to really address the cost of healthcare for the business community. You know, the way businesses have, you know, they use healthcare benefits to attract and retain talent, right? So this is one of the reasons people want to work somewhere is that they get healthcare benefits because it's not affordable otherwise. But, you know, for example, in Indiana, the cost is $21,000, over $21,000 for family for employer-sponsored insurance. The median household income in Indiana, I think, is around $53,000. So about 37% of median household income is spent on healthcare. Now, the employer is paying about $15,000 and the worker is paying around $5,500 or close to $6,000, somewhere around in that area. So, you know, the reality is that it's not really affordable for the workers. It's not affordable for the businesses as well. And so they're constantly trying to figure out how to optimize care and reduce spending, but also recognizing that, you know, they have to be able to kind of use their purchasing power to leverage their influence in a way that changes the trajectory of healthcare. And so it's a little bit easier said than done, but that a lot of them have been trying to do is kind of leverage their influence to change healthcare spending.
Yeah. And if you know, so the employer is not really winning out, the employees are not winning, the hospitals are struggling. Who is winning? The insurance companies?
Or no one.
No one. Okay.
I guess I don't know what winning means, but I would say,
I guess profiting, you know, the most, like,
you know,
at the top of the food chain.
Who's at the, probably some of those CEOs making, you know, $35 million. We kind of look at this as we're all part of the problem and we're all part of the solution. So when you're really trying to look at affordability, there's three components to that, and that's health. So if you're, you know, less healthy populations are going to cost more. There's price, which we talked about, but there's also waste. And about 30% of U.S. healthcare is considered to be wasteful, meaning you didn't need the procedure, maybe. And there's a tendency to blame patients for this, Like maybe you went to ER when you shouldn't. And that does happen, but there's also unnecessary surgeries that happen and inappropriate care. So we think about affordability about around health, price, and waste, and that's pretty well what the employers think about. And they're starting to really think a lot around, you know, we've known there's disparities in care for years. But when you look at the racial justice movement in the last year, you'll see that employers are now trying to figure out how they can address inequities all across their workforce, but particularly around healthcare and thinking about, you know, how can I make sure that my workers are getting access to equitable care? Because that's just not happening. And we can talk another day on maybe social determinants of health, but that's just,
yeah,
because your zip code is the biggest predictor of your health.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Where you live.
Okay. Well, you've been just so much. I just learn so much every time I talk to you.
I just stay so quiet because I'm just like trying to take it all in and like make sense of it because it's still.
Yeah.
You definitely have.
My goal with all of the work I do is I want to be more informed when I make pronouncements. You know, like that's my kind of, my personality is one to be like, I think this and it's because this, but you know, I want to have more information that is giving me the tools when I talk about it with people. And I think that that's what is so beneficial about what you do is, you know, okay, you may think this, but what's it going to look like? Is it realistic? How do we get there? You know, it's not just as simple as a belief system. You have to actually implement change.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, make sure that I acknowledge that incredible stress and burden that our healthcare providers have been under, the extraordinary courage that they've gone through in the last year, and the work that our hospitals have been done has been phenomenal. And so we need hospitals to really thrive and do well. So also when you were talking about how do we solve for it, I mean, I always say we're all part of the problem and we're all part of the solution. So we try to find ways to collaborate. But one physician dies by suicide every day in this country. And so you know, I mentioned the triple aim at the beginning, but there's now quadruple aim, which is thinking about provider health. And, you know, this burden and the administrative burden and the quality reporting and the payment systems and all these things, it just burns our physicians out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and our nurses. And so my hat's off to all of them. It's just like this monstrosity of a system that's very difficult that we're all kind of in. Yeah, that's very difficult to change.
Yeah. Well, we thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And we hope to have you back someday.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Anytime. Bye.
All right. Well, what a wealth of knowledge. I just learned so much, and I mean, there's still so much to learn about it, you know.
I'm sure that she's like, we barely even scratched.
I know, 45 minutes is not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough, and we will put her. She is the CEO and director of a nonprofit, and we will put all of her info in the show notes if you know want to look into what she does more. She really has completely changed my way of thinking on healthcare over the years I've known her. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, what has been keeping you going the last 2 weeks?
Top Chef is back.
Top Chef.
That's it. That's what, I mean, my favorite show, easily one of my favorite shows of all time. It's back. It's on, and I'm loving it. They actually filmed during COVID. So they brought all the chefs and like, put them in a bubble, and it's really interesting because a lot of them like had just closed their restaurant down. It was filmed in the summer.
Oh, wow.
And so far it's great.
I'm surprised. I mean, that was a huge thing. I kept hearing podcasts about like, you know, mm-hmm. kitchens and all that stuff be closing.
Oh, yeah, totally. And Tom Colicchio, who hosts or is one of the judges on Top Chef, like, he's been instrumental in a lot of the Recovery Act provisions for restaurants. And he's a really great follow on Twitter if you're still on there. I'm not really, but he is just doing great work for restaurants this year as far as financial aid and things like that. But I'm also listening and reading to Padma Lakshmi's memoir. She's the host of the show, mm-hmm. Top Chef. Wow, she's interesting. She's had a crazy life.
I don't know
life.
Anything about her. She's Indian, is that correct? Okay.
Yes, she's Indian-American, and she lived kind of half her life in India, half her life in the U.S. growing up, and was married to Salman Rushdie at one time, and she's just wild. I'm really enjoying that.
Cool.
Yeah, but that's it.
I've been we started watching The Great Pottery Throwdown. It's just another
okay.
which kind of goes along with the Great British Baking Show, you know, like the whole idea. Uh-huh.
I tried to watch one on glass blowing.
Ooh,
that I think was
that's
the same.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's on Netflix. I didn't get past the first episode.
So there's something to say about those type, because I mean obviously you watch Top Chef and all that, and it's like the American mm-hmm. way of like, it's like very competitive, very like single-minded, and then you watch a British show and it's like all about love and support, and like it's like a healthy competitiveness. Yes. And it's like, I don't know, like I am competitive, but I also like working as a community to get things together. Mm-hmm. I think that's
so. Is this Pottery Throwdown British too?
Yeah, it is. And they they go around. I think they had to move their location for due to COVID. And they're at this different. I can't remember where they are, but now they're all living because when they were filming during COVID, they all had to live together and they had mm-hmm. to move locations. But they all take place in these older old school pottery production places, and it's really cool.
Gotcha.
In addition to that, I've heard about this artist, and his name is Lil Nas X, and he
Old Town Road.
Yeah,
and take me down that Old Town Road.
Was it Billy Ray Cyrus is in it? And so he's been really controversial, and I don't know. His topics are about, he's a black gay man, and I think from what I learned, he grew up in a Christian kind of community, and he was told that he was like being gay is the devil and all that, and so he's choosing to kind of embrace that from what I understand, and so his music mm-hmm. videos are very like theatrical, and he's like he put out a shoe line that was like about the devil, and then there's like a whole controversy about putting human blood in him, and then Nike,
oh wait a minute, I
okay.
know this.
It gets really crazy, and I'm just like, man, this guy's going far beyond. Like I thought Kanye West was crazy, and
he's on a whole nother level,
and I don't even know where I stand. Like I want to learn more about him. I think he's just like a creative out there person who's pushing the boundaries
right.
of like
right almost like performance
yes,
art
yes.
yeah I saw that on somewhere about the shoe with the blood, and I was like, what in the world? And then I just, of course, like, you know, lemon brain, I didn't follow up on it. I was just like scrolling and
Nike like sued him, I believe, because they said, we had no affiliation with this, we don't want any, you know, like they didn't have anything to do with mm-hmm. this, and they don't want to be connected to it.
Yeah.
So he's not just a performer, I think he's like really pushing boundaries here, and I am interested in this whole thing. I mean, I don't want to say I like him or dislike him, I'm just really interested in where this
fascinated
goes.
By what he's
I
doing
mean, you know, I mean, Kanye West was
I'll have
bizarre.
To look into it
you
a
know,
little
Kanye
more.
Kanye West was like this weird guy that just like pushed the boundaries, but this is a whole new level of like pushing those boundaries.
Interesting. The only experience I have with him is that I was in a yoga class a couple years ago, and Old Town Road came on in the middle of the class on the playlist, and I was like, Okay.
The music's not even.
It was an interesting choice.
I think the music itself, the lyrics are not, like, to me, they seem pretty mild. It's like the performance. He's like, mm-hmm. like the visual language of his work is what really gets out there.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated by the connection between rap and country or hip hop and country, because I feel like they're so similar in so many ways.
How? Like,
not the actual, not the sound of the music, but like what the music is about. Like
it's about life in some way.
It's about lifestyle. It's about vehicles, about drinking. It's about partying. It's about love. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, objectifying women, being a macho mm-hmm. man. Like, it's all the exact same music, but just obviously it sounds a lot different in your earballs, but...
I guess you just gave me the recipe to be a musician. I think I'm gonna write my first song.
You know, this is it. Yeah.
Wow.
Well. All right. Well, if you want to call us, we need some voicemails, people. Yeah,
give us a call. Tell us what you think.
502-653-9157. Call us, leave us a voicemail. You can also text us at that number, and that is great. And you can find us on Instagram at @blue.harrisoncounty or Facebook.
Yep, and if you want to get a notification on the next time we post our show, go ahead and subscribe on anywhere you're listening to your podcast, and you'll be notified.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, well, see you later.
See you guys later.
Bye.